Chapter 34. The Palazzo Vecchio resembles a giant chess piece, with its robust quadrangular facade and rusticated square-cut battlements. The massive rook-like building is aptly situated, guarding the southeast corner of the Piazza della Signoria. The building's unusual single spire, rising off-center from within the square fortress, cuts a distinctive profile against the skyline, and has become an inimitable symbol of Florence. But as a potent seat of Italian government, the building imposes on its arriving visitors an intimidating array of masculine statuary. Amanati's muscular Neptune stands naked atop four seahorses, a symbol of Florence's dominance in the sea. A replica of Michelangelo's David, arguably the world's most admired male nude, stands in all his glory at the palazzo entrance. David is joined by Hercules and Cacus, two more colossal naked men, who, in concert with a host of Neptune's satyrs, bring to more than a dozen the total number of exposed penises that greet visitors to the palazzo. Normally, Langdon's visits to the Palazzo Vecchio had begun here on the Piazza della Signoria, which, despite its overabundance of phalluses, had always been one of his favorite plazas in all of Europe. No trip to the piazza was complete without sipping an espresso at Café Revoir, followed by a visit to the Medici Lions in the Loggia dei Lanzi, the piazza's open-air sculpture gallery. Today, however, Langdon and his companion planned to enter the Palazzo Vecchio via the Vasari corridor, much as Medici dukes might have done in their day, bypassing the famous Uffizi gallery and following the corridor as it snaked above bridges, over roads, and through buildings, leading directly into the heart of the old palace. Thus far, they had heard no trace of footsteps behind them, but Langdon was still anxious to exit the corridor. "And now we've arrived," Langdon realized, eyeing the heavy wooden door before them. "The entrance to the old palace." The door, despite its substantial locking mechanism, was equipped with a horizontal push bar, which provided emergency exit capability while preventing anyone on the other side from entering the Vasari corridor without a key card. Langdon placed his ear to the door and listened. Hearing nothing on the other side, he put his hands against the bar and pushed gently. The lock clicked. As the wooden portal creaked open a few inches, Langdon peered into the world beyond. A small alcove. Empty. Silent. With a small sigh of relief, Langdon stepped through and motioned for Sienna to follow. "We're in." Standing in a quiet alcove somewhere inside the Palazzo Vecchio, Langdon waited a moment and tried to get his bearings. In front of them, a long hallway ran perpendicular to the alcove. To their left, in the distance, voices echoed up the corridor, calm and jovial. The Palazzo Vecchio, much like the United States Capitol building, was both a tourist attraction and a governmental office. At this hour, the voices they heard were most likely those of civic employees bustling in and out of offices, getting ready for the day. Langdon and Sienna inched toward the hallway and peered around the corner. Sure enough, at the end of the hallway was an atrium in which a dozen or so government employees stood around sipping morning espressi and chatting with colleagues before work.
"The Vasari mural," Sienna whispered. "You said it's in the Hall of the 500?
Langdon nodded and pointed across the crowded atrium toward a portico that opened into a stone hallway. "Unfortunately, it's through that atrium."
"You're sure?"
Langdon nodded. "We'll never make it through without being seen."
"They're government workers. They'll have no interest in us. Just walk like you belong here."
Sienna reached up and gently smoothed out Langdon's Brioni suit jacket and adjusted his collar.
"You look very presentable, Robert."
She gave him a demure smile, adjusted her own sweater, and set out. Langdon hurried after her, both of them striding purposefully toward the atrium. As they entered, Sienna began talking to him in rapid Italian, something about farm subsidies, gesticulating passionately as she spoke. They kept to the outer wall, maintaining their distance from the others. To Langdon's amazement, not one single employee gave them a second glance. When they were beyond the atrium, they quickly pressed onward toward the hallway. Langdon recalled the Shakespeare playbill, Mischievous Puck. "You're quite an actress," he whispered.
"I've had to be,"
she said reflexively, her voice strangely distant. Once again, Langdon sensed there was more heartache in this young woman's past than he knew, and he felt a deepening sense of remorse for having entangled her in his dangerous predicament. He reminded himself that there was nothing to be done now except to see it through. Keep swimming through the tunnel and pray for light. As they neared their portico, Langdon was relieved to see that his memory had served him well. A small plaque with an arrow pointed around the corner into the hallway and announced, "Il Salone de Cinquecento." The Hall of the 500, Langdon thought, wondering what answers awaited within. The truth can be glimpsed only through the eyes of death. What could this mean? The room may still be locked, Langdon warned as they neared the corner. Although the Hall of the 500 was a popular tourist destination, the palazzo did not appear to be open yet to tourists this morning.
"Do you hear that?"
Sienna asked, stopping short. Langdon heard it. A loud humming noise was coming from just around the corner. "Please tell me it's not an indoor drone." Cautiously, Langdon peered around the corner of the portico. 30 yards away stood the surprisingly simple wooden door that opened into the Hall of the 500. Regrettably, directly between them stood a portly custodian pushing an electric floor-buffing machine in weary circles. Guardian of the gate. Langdon's attention shifted to three symbols on a plastic sign outside the door. Decipherable to even the least experienced of symbologists, these universal icons were a video camera with an X through it, a drinking cup with an X through it, and a pair of boxy stick figures, one female, one male. Langdon took charge, striding swiftly toward the custodian, breaking into a jog as he drew nearer. Sienna rushed behind him to keep up. The custodian glanced up, looking startled.
"Signore?"
He held out his arms for Langdon and Sienna to stop. Langdon gave the man a pained smile, more of a wince, and motioned apologetically toward the symbols near the door.
"Toilette,"
he declared, his voice pinched. It was not a question. The custodian hesitated a moment, looking ready to deny their request, and then finally, watching Langdon shift uncomfortably before him, he gave a sympathetic nod and waved them through. When they reached the door, Langdon gave Sienna a quick wink. Compassion is a universal language. Chapter 35. At one time, the Hall of the 500 was the largest room in the world. It had been built in 1494 to provide a meeting hall for the entire Consiglio Maggiore, the Republic's Grand Council of precisely 500 members, from which the hall drew its name. Some years later, at the behest of Cosimo I, the room was renovated and enlarged substantially. Cosimo I, the most powerful man in Italy, chose as the project's overseer and architect the great Giorgio Vasari. In an exceptional feat of engineering, Vasari had raised the original roof substantially and permitted natural light to flow in through high transoms on all four sides of the room, resulting in an elegant showroom for some of Florence's finest architecture, sculpture, and painting. For Langdon, it was always the floor of this room that first drew his eye, immediately announcing that this was no ordinary space. The crimson stone parquet was overlaid with a black grid, giving the 12,000-square-foot expanse an air of solidity, depth, and balance. Langdon raised his eyes slowly to the far side of the room, where six dynamic sculptures, the labors of Hercules, lined the wall like a phalanx of soldiers. Langdon intentionally ignored the oft-maligned Hercules and Diomedes, whose naked bodies were locked in an awkward-looking wrestling match, which included a creative, penile grip that always made Langdon cringe. Far easier on the eyes was Michelangelo's breathtaking Genius of Victory, which stood to the right, dominating the central niche in the south wall. At nearly 9 feet tall, this sculpture had been intended for the tomb of the ultra-conservative Pope Julius II, Il Papa Terribile, a commission Langdon had always found ironic, considering the Vatican's stance on homosexuality. The statue depicted Tommaso de Cavalieri, the young man with whom Michelangelo had been in love for much of his life, and to whom he composed over 300 sonnets.
I can't believe I've never been here, Sienna whispered beside him,
her voice suddenly quiet and reverent.
This is beautiful.
Langdon nodded, recalling his first visit to this space, on the occasion of a spectacular concert of classical music featuring the world-renowned pianist Mariel Kimo. Although this grand hall was originally intended for private political meetings and audiences with the Grand Duke, nowadays it more commonly featured popular musicians, lecturers, and gala dinners. From art historian Maurizio Saracini to the Gucci Museum's star-studded black-and-white gala opening. Langdon sometimes wondered how Cosimo I would feel about sharing his austere private hall with CEOs and fashion models. Langdon lifted his gaze now to the enormous murals adorning the walls. Their bizarre history included a failed experimental painting technique by Leonardo da Vinci, which resulted in a melting masterpiece. There had also been an artistic showdown, spearheaded by Piero Soderini and Machiavelli, which pitted against each other two titans of the Renaissance, Michelangelo and Leonardo, commanding them to create murals on opposite walls of the same room. Today, however, Langdon was more interested in one of the room's other historical oddities.
Cerca Trova. Which one is the Vasari?
Sienna asked, scanning the murals. Nearly all of them, Langdon replied, knowing that as part of the room's renovation, Vasari and his assistants had repainted almost everything in it, from the original wall murals to the 39 coffered panels adorning its famed hanging ceiling. But that mural there, Langdon said, pointing to the mural on their far right, is the one we came to see, Vasari's Battle of Marciano. The military confrontation was absolutely massive, 55 feet long and more than 3 stories tall. It was rendered in ruddy shades of brown and green, a violent panorama of soldiers, horses, spears, and banners, all colliding on a pastoral hillside.
Vasari, Vasari, Sienna whispered. And hidden in there somewhere is his secret message?
Langdon nodded as he squinted toward the top of the huge mural, trying to locate the particular green battle flag on which Vasari had painted his mysterious message. Cerca Trova. It's almost impossible to see from down here without binoculars, Langdon said, pointing. But in the top middle section, if you look just below the 2 farmhouses on the hillside, there's a tiny, tilted green flag and—
I see it,
Sienna said, pointing to the upper right quadrant, precisely in the right spot. Langdon wished he had younger eyes. The two walked closer to the towering mural, and Langdon gazed up at its splendor. Finally, they were here. The only problem now was that Langdon was not sure why they were here. He stood in silence for several long moments, staring up at the details of Vasari's masterpiece. If I fail, then all is death. A door creaked open behind them, and the custodian with the floor buffer peered in, looking uncertain. Sienna gave a friendly wave. The custodian eyed them a moment and then closed the door.
We don't have much time, Robert, Sienna urged. You need to think. Does the painting ring any bells for you? Any memories at all?
Langdon scrutinized the chaotic battle scene above them. The truth can be glimpsed only through the eyes of death. Langdon had thought perhaps the mural included a corpse whose dead eyes were gazing blankly off toward some other clue in the painting, or perhaps even elsewhere in the room. Unfortunately, Langdon now saw that there were dozens of dead bodies in the mural, none of them particularly noteworthy, and none with dead eyes directed anywhere in particular.
The truth can be glimpsed only through the eyes of death?
He tried to envision connecting lines from one corpse to another, wondering if a shape might emerge. But he saw nothing. Langdon's head was throbbing again as he frantically plumbed the depths of his memory. Somewhere down there, the voice of the silver-haired woman kept whispering,
"Seek, and ye shall find."
"Find what?" Langdon wanted to shout. He forced himself to close his eyes and exhale slowly. He rolled his shoulders a few times and tried to free himself from all conscious thought, hoping to tap into his gut instinct. "Very sorry. Vasari. Cherkatrova. The truth can be glimpsed only through the eyes of death." His gut told him, without a doubt, that he was standing in the right location. And while he was not yet sure why, he had the distinct sense that he was moments away from finding what he had come here seeking. Agent Bruder stared blankly at the red velvet pantaloons and tunic in the display case before him and cursed under his breath. His SRS team had searched the entire costume gallery, and Langdon and Sienna Brooks were nowhere to be found.
"Surveillance and response support," he thought angrily. "Since when does a college professor elude SRS? Where the hell did they go?"
"Every exit was sealed," one of his men insisted. "The only possibility is that they are still in the gardens." While this seemed logical, Bruder had the sinking sensation that Langdon and Sienna Brooks had found some other way out.
"Get the drone back in the air," Bruder snapped, "and tell the local authorities to widen the search area outside the walls." "God damn it."
As his men dashed off, Bruder grabbed his phone and called the person in charge.
"It's Bruder," he said. "I'm afraid we've got a serious problem. A number of them, actually."
Chapter 36.
"The truth can be glimpsed only through the eyes of death." Sienna repeated the words to herself as she continued to search every inch of Vasari's brutal battle scene, hoping something might stand out. She saw eyes of death everywhere.
"Which ones are we looking for?"
She wondered if maybe the eyes of death were a reference to all the rotting corpses strewn across Europe by the Black Death.
"At least that would explain the plague mask."
Out of the blue, a childhood nursery rhyme jumped into Sienna's mind.
"Ring around the rosy, a pocket full of posies. Ashes, ashes, we all fall down."
She used to recite the poem as a schoolgirl in England, until she heard that it derived from the Great Plague of London in 1665. Allegedly, a ring around the rosy was a reference to a rose-colored pustule on the skin that developed a ring around it and indicated that one was infected. Sufferers would carry a pocket full of posies in an effort to mask the smell of their own decaying bodies, as well as the stench of the city itself, where hundreds of plague victims dropped dead daily, their bodies then cremated.
"Ashes, ashes, we all fall down."
"For the love of God," Langdon blurted suddenly, wheeling around toward the opposite wall. Sienna looked over.
"What's wrong?"
"That's the name of a piece of art that was once on display here. For the love of God." Bewildered, Sienna watched Langdon hurry across the room to a small glass door, which he tried to open. It was locked. He put his face to the glass, cupping his hands around his eyes and peering inside. Whatever Langdon was looking for, Sienna hoped he spotted it in a hurry. The custodian had just reappeared, now with a look of deepening suspicion at the sight of Langdon sauntering off to snoop at a locked door. Sienna waved cheerfully to the custodian, but the man glared at her for a long, cold beat, and then disappeared.
Lo Studiolo.
Positioned behind a glass door, directly opposite the hidden words Cherkatrova in the Hall of the 500, was nestled a tiny windowless chamber. Designed by Vasari as a secret study for Francesco I, the rectangular studiolo rose to a rounded, barrel-vaulted ceiling, which gave those inside the feeling of being inside a giant treasure chest. Fittingly, the interior glistened with objects of beauty. More than 30 rare paintings adorned the walls and ceiling, mounted so close to one another that they left virtually no empty wall space. The fall of Icarus, an allegory of human life. Nature presenting Prometheus with spectacular gems. As Langdon peered through the glass into the dazzling space beyond, he whispered to himself, "The eyes of death." Langdon had first been inside Lo Studiolo during a private secret passages tour of the palazzo a few years back, and had been stunned to learn about the plethora of hidden doors, stairs, and passageways that honeycombed the palazzo, including several hidden behind paintings inside Lo Studiolo. The secret passages, however, were not what had just sparked Langdon's interest. Instead, he had flashed on a bold piece of modern art that he had once seen on display here, For the Love of God, a controversial piece by Damien Hirst, which had caused an uproar when it was shown inside Vasari's famed Studiolo. A life-size cast of a human skull in solid platinum, its surface had been entirely covered with more than 8,000 glittering pavé-set diamonds. The effect was striking. The skull's empty eye sockets glistened with light and life, creating a troubling juxtaposition of opposing symbols. Life and death, beauty and horror. Although Hirst's diamond skull had long since been removed from Lo Studiolo, Langdon's recollection of it had sparked an idea. The eyes of death, he thought. A skull certainly qualifies, doesn't it? Skulls were a recurring theme in Dante's Inferno, most famously Count Ugolino's brutal punishment in the lowest circle of hell, that of being sentenced to gnaw eternally on the skull of a wicked archbishop. Are we looking for a skull? The enigmatic Studiolo, Langdon knew, had been built in the tradition of a cabinet of curiosities. Nearly all of its paintings were secretly hinged, swinging open to reveal hidden cupboards in which the Duke had kept strange possessions of interest to him. Rare mineral samples, beautiful feathers, a perfect fossil of a nautilus shell, and even, allegedly, a monk's tibia decorated with hand-pounded silver. Unfortunately, Langdon suspected all the cupboard items had been removed long ago, and he had never heard of any skull on display here other than Hirst's piece. His thoughts were cut short by the loud slam of a door on the far side of the hall. The brisk click of footsteps approached quickly across the salon.
"Signore!" an angry voice shouted. "Il salone non è aperto."
Langdon turned to see a female employee marching toward him. She was petite, with short brown hair. She was also extremely pregnant. The woman moved snappily toward them, tapping her watch and shouting something about the hall not yet being open. As she drew near, she made eye contact with Langdon and immediately stopped short, covering her mouth in shock.
"Professor Langdon,"
she exclaimed, looking embarrassed.
"I'm so sorry. I didn't know you were here. Welcome back."
Langdon froze. He was quite certain he had never seen this woman before in his life. Chapter 37.
"I almost didn't recognize you, Professor,"
the woman gushed in accented English as she approached Langdon.
"It's your clothing."
She smiled warmly and gave Langdon's Brioni suit an appreciative nod.
"Very fashionable. You look almost Italian."
Langdon's mouth went bone dry, but he managed a polite smile as the woman joined him. "Good morning," he stumbled. "How are you?" She laughed, holding her belly.
"Exhausted. Little Catalina kicked all night."
The woman glanced around the room, looking puzzled.
"Il Duomino didn't mention you were coming back today. I assume he's with you?"
"Il Duomino?" Langdon had no idea who she was talking about. The woman apparently saw his confusion and gave a reassuring chuckle.
"It's okay. Everybody in Florence calls him by that nickname. He doesn't mind."
She glanced around.
"Did he let you in?"
"He did,"
Sienna said, arriving from across the hall.
"But he had a breakfast meeting. He said you wouldn't mind if we stayed to look around."
Sienna enthusiastically extended her hand.
I'm Sienna, Robert's sister.
The woman gave Sienna's hand an overly official handshake.
I'm Marta Alvarez. Aren't you the lucky one, having Professor Langdon as a private guide?
Yes, Sienna enthused, barely hiding the roll of her eyes.
He's so smart.
There was an awkward pause as the woman studied Sienna.
Funny,
she said.
I don't see any family resemblance at all, except perhaps your height.
Langdon sensed an impending train wreck. Now or never. Marta, Langdon interrupted, hoping he had heard her name correctly. I'm sorry to trouble you, but, well, I guess you can probably imagine why I'm here.
Actually, no,
she replied, her eyes narrowing.
I can't for the life of me imagine what you would be doing here.
Langdon's pulse quickened, and in the awkward silence that followed, he realized his gamble was about to crash and burn. Suddenly, Marta broke into a broad smile and laughed out loud.
Professor, I'm joking. Of course I can guess why you returned. Frankly, I don't know why you find it so fascinating, but since you and Il Duomino spent almost an hour up there last night, I'm guessing you have come back to show your sister?
Right, he managed. Exactly, I'd love to show Sienna, if that's not an inconvenience. Marta glanced up to the second-floor balcony and shrugged.
No problem. I'm headed up there now.
Langdon's heart pounded as he looked up to the second-story balcony at the rear of the hall. I was up there last night. He remembered nothing. The balcony, he knew, in addition to being at the exact same height as the words Cerca Trova, also served as the entrance to the Palazzo's museum, which Langdon visited whenever he was here. Marta was about to lead them across the hall when she paused, as if having second thoughts.
Actually, Professor, are you sure we can't find something a bit less grim to show your lovely sister?
Langdon had no idea how to respond.
We're seeing something grim?
Sienna asked.
What is it? He hasn't told me.
Marta gave a coy smile and glanced at Langdon.
Professor, would you like me to tell your sister about it, or would you prefer to do so yourself?
Langdon nearly jumped at the opportunity. By all means, Marta. Why don't you tell her all about it? Marta turned back to Sienna, speaking very slowly now.
I don't know what your brother has told you, but we're going up to the museum to see a very unusual mask.
Sienna's eyes widened a bit.
What kind of mask? One of those ugly plague masks they wear at Carnivale? Good guess,
Marta said.
But no, it's not a plague mask. It's a much different kind of mask. It's called a death mask.
Langdon's gasp of revelation was audible, and Marta scowled at him, apparently thinking he was being overly dramatic in an attempt to frighten his sister.
Don't listen to your brother, she said. Death masks were a very common practice in the 1500s. It's essentially just a plaster cast of someone's face, taken a few moments after that person dies.
The death mask. Langdon felt the first moment of clarity he'd felt since waking up in Florence. Dante's Inferno? Cerca Trova? Looking through the eyes of death? The mask. Sienna asked,
Whose face was used to cast the mask?
Langdon put his hand on Sienna's shoulder and answered as calmly as possible. A famous Italian poet. His name was Dante Alighieri. Chapter 38. The Mediterranean sun shone brightly on the decks of the Mendacium as it rocked over the Adriatic swells. Feeling weary, the provost drained his second scotch and gazed blankly out his office window. The news from Florence was not good. Perhaps it was on account of his first taste of alcohol in a very long time, but he was feeling strangely disoriented and powerless, as if his ship had lost its engines and were drifting aimlessly on the tide. The sensation was a foreign one to the provost. In his world, there always existed a dependable compass. Protocol. and it had never failed to show the way. Protocol was what enabled him to make difficult decisions without ever looking back. It had been protocol that required Vianthus' disavowal, and the provost had carried out the deed with no hesitation.
I will deal with her once this current crisis has passed.
It had been protocol that required the provost to know as little as possible about all of his clients. He had decided long ago that the consortium had no ethical responsibility to judge them.
Provide the service, trust the client, ask no questions.
Like the directors of most companies, the provost simply offered services with the assumption that those services would be implemented within the framework of the law. After all, Volvo had no responsibility to ensure that soccer moms didn't speed through school zones, any more than Dell would be held responsible if someone used one of their computers to hack into a bank account. Now, with everything unraveling, the provost quietly cursed the trusted contact who had suggested this client to the consortium. He will be low maintenance and easy money, the contact had assured him. The man is brilliant, a star in his field, and absurdly wealthy. He simply needs to disappear for a year or two. He wants to buy some time off the grid to work on an important project. The provost had agreed without much thought. Long-term relocations were always easy money, and the provost trusted his contact's instincts. As expected, the job had been very easy money. That is, until last week. Now, in the wake of the chaos created by this man, the provost found himself pacing in circles around a bottle of scotch and counting the days until his responsibilities to this client were over. The phone on his desk rang. The provost saw it was Knowlton, one of his top facilitators, calling from downstairs. Yes? He answered.
Sir, Knowlton began, an uneasy edge in his voice. I hate to bother you with this, but, as you may know, we're tasked with uploading a video to the media tomorrow.
Yes, the provost replied. Is it prepped?
It is, but I thought you might want to preview it before upload.
The provost paused, puzzled by the comment.
Does the video mention us by name or compromise us in some way?
No, sir, but the content is quite disturbing. The client appears on screen and says,
Stop right there, the provost ordered. Stunned that a senior facilitator would dare suggest such a blatant breach of protocol. The content is immaterial. Whatever it says, his video would have been released with or without us. The client could just as easily have released this video electronically. But he hired us. He paid us. He trusted us.
Yes, sir.
You were not hired to be a film critic, the provost admonished. You were hired to keep promises. Do your job.
On the Ponte Vecchio, Vianthus waited, her sharp eyes scanning the hundreds of faces on the bridge. She had been vigilant and felt certain that Langdon had not yet passed her. But the drone had fallen silent, its tracking apparently no longer required.
Bruder must have caught him.
Reluctantly, she began to ponder the grim prospect of a consortium inquiry, or worse. Vianthus again pictured the two agents who had been disavowed, never heard from again.
They simply moved to different work, she assured herself.
Nonetheless, she now found herself wondering if she should just drive into the hills of Tuscany, disappear, and use her skills to find a new life.
But how long could I hide from them?
Countless targets had learned firsthand that when the consortium set you in its sights, privacy became an illusion. It was only a matter of time.
Is my career really ending like this?
She wondered, still unable to accept that her 12-year tenure at the consortium would be terminated over a series of unlucky breaks. For a year, she had vigilantly overseen the needs of the consortium's green-eyed client.
It was not my fault he jumped to his death, and yet I seemed to be falling along with him.
Her only chance at redemption had been to outfox Bruder, but she'd known from the start that this was a long shot.
I had my chance last night, and I failed.
as Vianta reluctantly turned back toward her motorcycle, she became suddenly aware of a distant sound, a familiar, high-pitched whine. Puzzled, she glanced up. To her surprise, the surveillance drone had just lifted off again, this time near the farthest end of the Pitti Palace. Vianta watched as the tiny craft began flying desperate circles over the palace. The drone's deployment could mean only one thing.
They still don't have Langdon. Where the hell is he?
The piercing whine overhead again pulled Dr. Elizabeth Sinsky from her delirium.
The drone is up again, but I thought...
She shifted in the back seat of the van, where the same young agent was still seated beside her. She closed her eyes again, fighting the pain and nausea. Mostly, though, she fought the fear.
Time is running out.
Even though her enemy had jumped to his death, she still saw his silhouette in her dreams, lecturing her in the darkness of the Council on Foreign Relations. It is imperative that someone take bold action, he had declared, his green eyes flashing. If not us, who? If not now, when? Elizabeth knew she should have stopped him right then, when she had the chance. She would never forget storming out of that meeting and fuming in the back of the limo as she headed across Manhattan toward JFK International Airport. Eager to know who the hell this maniac could be, she pulled out her cell phone to look at the surprise snapshot she had taken of him. When she saw the photo, she gasped aloud. Dr. Elizabeth Sinsky knew exactly who this man was. The good news was that he would be very easy to track. The bad news was that he was a genius in his field. A very dangerous person, should he choose to be.
Nothing is more creative, nor destructive, than a brilliant mind with a purpose.
By the time she arrived at the airport 30 minutes later, she had called her team and placed this man on the bioterrorism watch lists of every relevant agency on Earth. The CIA, the CDC, the ECDC, and all of their sister organizations around the world.
That's all I can do until I get back to Geneva, she thought.
Exhausted, she carried her overnight bag to check-in and handed the attendant her passport and ticket.
Oh, Dr. Sinsky, the attendant said with a smile. A very nice gentleman just left a message for you. I'm sorry?
Elizabeth knew of nobody who had access to her flight information.
He was very tall, the attendant said, with green eyes.
Elizabeth literally dropped her bag.
He's here? How?
She spun around, looking at the faces behind her.
He left already, the attendant said, but he wanted us to give you this.
She handed Elizabeth a folded piece of stationery. Shaking, Elizabeth unfolded the paper and read the handwritten note. It was a famous quote derived from the work of Dante Alighieri. The darkest places in hell are reserved for those who maintain their neutrality in times of moral crisis. Chapter 39. Marta Alvarez gazed tiredly up the steep staircase that ascended from the Hall of the 500 to the second-floor museum.
Posso farcela,
she told herself. I can do it. As an arts and culture administrator at the Palazzo Vecchio, Marta had climbed these stairs countless times. But recently, being more than 8 months pregnant, she found the ascent significantly more taxing. Marta, are you sure we don't want to take the elevator? Robert Langdon looked concerned and motioned to the small service elevator nearby, which the Palazzo had installed for handicapped visitors. Marta smiled appreciatively, but shook her head.
As I told you last night, my doctor says the exercise is good for the baby. Besides, Professor, I know you're claustrophobic.
Langdon seemed strangely startled by her comment. Oh, right, I forgot I mentioned that.
Forgot he mentioned it?
Marta puzzled.
It was less than 12 hours ago, and we discussed at length the childhood incident that led to the fear.
Last night, while Langdon's morbidly obese companion, Il Duomino ascended in the elevator. Langdon had accompanied Marta on foot. En route, Langdon had shared with her a vivid description of a boyhood fall into an abandoned well that had left him with a nearly debilitating fear of cramped spaces. Now, while Langdon's younger sister bounded ahead, her blonde ponytail swinging behind her, Langdon and Marta ascended methodically, pausing several times so she could catch her breath.
"I'm surprised you want to see the mask again," she said. "Considering all the pieces in Florence, this one seems among the least interesting."
Langdon gave a non-committal shrug. "I've returned mainly so Sienna can see it. Thank you, by the way, for letting us in again."
"Of course."
Langdon's reputation would have sufficed last night to persuade Marta to open the gallery for him, but the fact that he'd been accompanied by Il Duomino meant that she really had no choice. Ignazio Busoni, the man known as Il Duomino, was something of a celebrity in the Florence cultural world. The longtime director of the Museo dell'Opera del Duomo, Ignazio oversaw all aspects of Florence's most prominent historical site, Il Duomo, the massive red-domed cathedral that dominated both the history and the skyline of Florence. His passion for the landmark, combined with his body weight of nearly 400 pounds and his perpetually red face, resulted in his good-natured nickname of Il Duomino, the Little Dome. Marta had no idea how Langdon had become acquainted with Il Duomino, but the latter had called her last evening and said he wanted to bring a guest for a private viewing of the Dante death mask. When the mystery guest turned out to be the famous American symbologist and art historian Robert Langdon, Marta had felt a bit of a thrill at having the opportunity to usher these two famous men into the Palazzo's gallery. Now, as they reached the top of the stairs, Marta placed her hands on her hips, breathing deeply. Sienna was already at the balcony railing, peering back down into the hall of the 500.
"My favorite view of the room," Marta panted. "You get an entirely different perspective on the murals. I imagine your brother told you about the mysterious message hidden in that one there?"
She pointed. Sienna nodded enthusiastically.
"Cerca trova."
As Langdon gazed toward the room, Marta watched him. In the light of the mezzanine windows, she couldn't help but notice that Langdon did not look as striking as he had last night. She liked his new suit, but he needed a shave, and his face seemed pale and weary. Also, his hair, which was thick and full last night, looked matted this morning, as if he had yet to take a shower. Marta turned back to the mural before he caught her staring.
"We're standing at nearly the exact height as Cerca Trova," Marta said. "You can almost see the words with the naked eye."
Langdon's sister seemed indifferent to the mural.
"Tell me about Dante's death mask. Why is it here at the Palazzo Vecchio?"
"Like brother, like sister," Marta thought with an inward groan, still perplexed that the mask held such fascination for them. Then again, the Dante death mask had a very strange history, especially recently, and Langdon was not the first to show a nearly maniacal fascination with it.
"Well, tell me, what do you know about Dante?"
The pretty young blonde shrugged.
"Just what everyone learns in school. Dante was an Italian poet most famous for writing the Divine Comedy, which describes his imagined journey through hell." "Partially correct," Marta replied. "In his poem, Dante eventually escapes hell, continues through purgatory, and finally arrives in paradise. If you ever read the Divine Comedy, you'll see his journey is divided into three parts: Inferno, Purgatorio, and Paradiso."
Marta motioned for them to follow her along the balcony toward the museum entrance.
"The reason the mask resides here in the Palazzo Vecchio has nothing to do with the Divine Comedy, though. It has to do with real history. Dante lived in Florence, and he loved this city as much as anyone could ever love a city. He was a very prominent and powerful Florentine, but there was a shift in political power, and Dante supported the wrong side, so he was exiled. thrown outside the city walls and told he could never come back.
Marta paused to catch her breath as they approached the museum entrance. Hands again on her hips, she leaned back and continued talking.
Some people claim that Dante's exile is the reason why his death mask looks so sad. But I have another theory. I'm a bit of a romantic, and I think the sad face has more to do with a woman named Beatrice. You see, Dante spent his entire life desperately in love with a young woman named Beatrice Portinari. But sadly, Beatrice married another man, which meant Dante had to live not only without his beloved Florence, but also without the woman he so deeply loved. His love for Beatrice became a central theme in the Divine Comedy.
Interesting,
Sienna said in a tone that suggested she had not heard a word.
And yet I'm still not clear on why the death mask is kept here inside the palazzo.
Marta found the young woman's insistence both unusual and bordering on impolite.
Well,
she continued, walking again.
When Dante died, he was still forbidden to enter Florence, and his body was buried in Ravenna. But because his true love, Beatrice, was buried in Florence, and because Dante so loved Florence, bringing his death mask here seemed like a kind-hearted tribute to the man.
I see, Sienna said. And the choice of this building in particular?
The Palazzo Vecchio is the oldest symbol of Florence, and, in Dante's time, was the heart of the city. In fact, there is a famous painting in the cathedral that shows Dante standing outside the walled city, banished, while visible in the background is his cherished Palazzo Tower. In many ways, by keeping his death mask here, we feel like Dante has finally been allowed to come home.
That's nice,
Sienna said, finally seeming satisfied.
Thank you.
Marta arrived at the door of the museum and rapped three times.
Sono io, Marta. Buongiorno.
Some keys rattled inside and the door opened. An elderly guard smiled tiredly at her and checked his watch.
È un po' presto,
he said with a smile. A little early. By way of explanation, Marta motioned to Langdon, and the guard immediately brightened.
Signore, bentornato.
Welcome back. Grazie, Langdon replied amiably as the guard motioned them all inside. They moved through a small foyer, where the guard disarmed a security system and then unlocked a second, heavier door. As the door swung open, he stepped aside, sweeping his arm out with a flourish.
Ecco il museo.
Marta smiled her thanks and led her guests inside. The space that made up this museum had originally been designed as government offices, which meant that rather than a sprawling, wide-open gallery space, it was a labyrinth of moderate-sized rooms and hallways which encircled half of the building.
The Dante death mask is around the corner,
Marta told Sienna.
It's displayed in a narrow space called Landito, which is essentially just a walkway between two larger rooms. An antique cabinet against the side wall holds the mask, which keeps it invisible until you draw even with it. For this reason, many visitors walk right past the mask without even noticing it.
Langdon was striding faster now, eyes straight ahead, as if the mask held some kind of strange power over him. Marta nudged Sienna and whispered,
Obviously, your brother is not interested in any of our other pieces. But as long as you're here, you shouldn't miss our bust of Machiavelli or the Mappamundi globe in the Hall of Maps.
Sienna nodded politely and kept moving, her eyes also straight ahead. Marta was barely able to keep pace. As they reached the third room, she had fallen behind a bit and finally stopped short.
Professor,
she called out, panting,
perhaps you want to show your sister some of the gallery before we see his mask?
Langdon turned, seeming distracted, as if returning to the present from some far-off thought. Excuse me? Marta breathlessly pointed to a nearby display case.
One of the earliest printed copies of the Divine Comedy?
When Langdon finally saw Marta dabbing her forehead and trying to catch her breath, he looked mortified.
Marta, forgive me.
Of course, yes. A quick glance at the text would be wonderful. Langdon hurried back, permitting Marta to guide them over to the antique case. Inside was a well-worn, leather-bound book, propped open to an ornate title page. La Divina Commedia, Dante Alighieri.
Incredible, Langdon said, sounding surprised.
I recognize the frontispiece.
I didn't know you had one of the original Neumeister editions.
Of course you knew, Marta thought, puzzled. I showed this to you last night.
In the mid-1400s, Langdon said hurriedly to Sienna, Johann Neumeister created the first printed edition of this work. Several hundred copies were printed, but only about a dozen survived. They're very rare.
It now seemed to Marta that Langdon had been playing dumb so he could show off for his younger sibling. It seemed a rather unbecoming immodesty for a professor whose reputation was one of academic humility.
This copy is on loan from the Laurentian Library, Marta offered. If you and Robert have not visited there, you should. They have a spectacular staircase designed by Michelangelo, which leads up to the world's first public reading room. The books there were actually chained to the seats, so nobody could take them out. Of course, many of the books were the only copies in the world.
Amazing, Sienna said, glancing deeper into the museum.
And the mask is this way? What's the hurry?
Marta needed another minute to regain her breath.
Yes, but you might be interested to hear about this.
She pointed across an alcove toward a small staircase that disappeared into the ceiling.
That goes up to a viewing platform in the rafters, where you can actually look down on Vasari's famous hanging ceiling. I'd be happy to wait here if you'd like to. Please, Marta,
Sienna interjected.
I'd love to see the mask. We're a little short on time.
Marta stared at the pretty young woman, perplexed. She very much disliked the new fashion of strangers calling each other by their first names.
I'm Signora Alvarez,
she silently chided.
And I'm doing you a favor. Okay, Sienna,
Marta said curtly.
The mask is right this way.
Marta wasted no more time offering Langdon and his sister informed commentary as they made their way through the winding suite of gallery rooms toward the mask. Last night, Langdon and Il Duomino had spent nearly a half hour in the narrow andito, viewing the mask. Marta, intrigued by the men's curiosity for the piece, had asked if their fascination was related somehow to the unusual series of events surrounding the mask over this past year. Langdon and Il Duomino had been coy, offering no real answer. Now, as they approached the andito, Langdon began explaining to his sister the simple process used to create a death mask. His description, Marta was pleased to hear, was perfectly accurate, unlike his bogus claim that he had not previously seen the museum's rare copy of the Divine Comedy. Shortly after death, Langdon described, the deceased is laid out and his face is coated with olive oil. Then a layer of wet plaster is caked onto the skin, covering everything, mouth, nose, eyelids, from the hairline down to the neck. Once hardened, the plaster is easily lifted off and used as a mold into which fresh plaster is poured. This plaster hardens into a perfectly detailed replica of the deceased's face. The practice was particularly widespread in commemorating eminent persons and men of genius. Dante, Shakespeare, Voltaire, Tasso, Keats, they all had death masks made.
And here we are at last,
Marta announced as the trio arrived outside the andito. She stepped aside and motioned for Langdon's sister to enter first.
The mask is in the display case against the wall on your left. We ask that you please stay outside the stanchions. Thank you.
Sienna entered the narrow corridor, walked toward the display case, and peered inside. Her eyes instantly went wide, and she glanced back at her brother with an expression of dread. Marta had seen the reaction 1,000 times. Visitors were often jolted and repulsed by their first glimpse of the mask. Dante's eerily crinkled visage, hooked nose, and closed eyes. Langdon strode in right behind Sienna, arriving beside her and looking into the display case. He immediately stepped back, his face also registering surprise. Marta groaned.
Che esagerato.
She followed them in, but when she gazed into the cabinet, she, too, gasped out loud.
Oh, mio Dio!
Marta Alvarez had expected to see Dante's familiar dead face staring back at her. But instead, all she saw was the red satin interior of the cabinet and the peg on which the mask normally hung. Marta covered her mouth and stared in horror at the empty display case. Her breathing accelerated and she grabbed one of the stanchions for support. Finally, she tore her eyes from the bare cabinet and wheeled in the direction of the night guards at the main entrance.
La maschera di Dante!
She shouted like a madwoman.
La maschera di Dante è sparita!
Chapter 40. Marta Alvarez trembled before the empty display cabinet. She hoped the tightness spreading through her abdomen was panic and not labor pains.
The Dante death mask is gone.
The two security guards were now on full alert, having arrived in the Andito, seen the empty case, and sprung into action. One had rushed to the nearby video control room to access security camera footage from last night, while the other had just finished phoning in the robbery to the police.
La polizia arriverà tra 20 minuti,
the guard told Marta as he hung up with the police.
20 minuti?
She demanded.
20 minutes? We've had a major art theft.
The guard explained that he'd been told most of the city police were currently handling a far more serious crisis, and they were trying to find an available agent to come and take a statement.
Che cosa potrebbe esserci di grave?
She ranted. What can be more serious? Langdon and Sienna shared an anxious glance, and Marta sensed that her two guests were suffering from sensory overload. Not surprising. Having simply stopped by for a quick look at the mask, they were now witnessing the aftermath of a major art theft. Last night, somehow, someone had gained access to the gallery and stolen Dante's death mask. Marta knew there were far more valuable pieces in the museum that could have been stolen, so she tried to count her blessings. Nonetheless, this was the first theft in this museum's history.
I don't even know the protocol.
Marta felt suddenly weak, and she again reached out to one of the stanchions for support. Both gallery guards appeared mystified, as they had recounted to Marta their exact actions and the events of last night. At around 10 o'clock, Marta had entered with Il Duomino and Langdon. A short while later, the threesome had exited together. The guards had relocked the doors, reset the alarm, and as far as they knew, nobody had been in or out of the gallery since that moment.
Impossible,
Marta had scolded in Italian.
The mask was in the cabinet when the three of us left last night, so obviously somebody has been inside the gallery since then.
The guards showed their palms, looking bewildered.
Noi non abbiamo visto nessuno.
Now, with the police on the way, Marta moved as rapidly as her pregnant body permitted in the direction of the security control room. Langdon and Sienna fell into step nervously behind her.
The security video,
Marta thought.
That will show us precisely who was in here last night.
3 blocks away, on the Ponte Vecchio, Bayantha moved into the shadows as a pair of police officers filtered through the crowd, canvassing the area with photos of Langdon. As the officers neared Vianta, one of their radios blared, a routine all-points bulletin from dispatch. The announcement was brief and in Italian, but Vianta caught the gist. Any available officer in the area of the Palazzo Vecchio should report to take a statement at the Palazzo Museum. The officers barely flinched, but Vianta's ears pricked up.
Il Museo di Palazzo Vecchio?
Last night's debacle, the fiasco that had all but destroyed her career, had occurred in the alleyways just outside the Palazzo Vecchio. The police bulletin continued in static-filled Italian that was mostly unintelligible, except for two words that stood out clearly. The name Dante Alighieri. Her body instantly tensed.
Dante Alighieri?
Most certainly, this was not coincidence. She spun in the direction of the Palazzo Vecchio and located its crenellated tower, peeking over the rooftops of the nearby buildings.
What exactly happened at the museum?
She wondered.
And when?
The specifics aside, Biantha had been a field analyst long enough to know that coincidence was far less common than most people imagined. The Palazzo Vecchio Museum and Dante? This had to relate to Langdon. Biantha had suspected all along that Langdon would return to the old city. It only made sense. The old city was where Langdon had been last night when everything had started to come undone. Now, in the light of day, Biantha wondered if Langdon had somehow returned to the area around the Palazzo Vecchio to find whatever it was he was seeking. She was certain Langdon had not crossed this bridge into the old city. There were plenty of other bridges, and yet they seemed to be impossibly far on foot from the bubbly gardens. Beneath her, she noticed a 4-man crew shell skimming across the water and passing under the bridge. The hull read, Società Canottieri Firenze, Florence Rowing Club. The shell's distinctive red and white oars rose and fell in perfect unison.
Could Langdon have taken a boat across?
It seemed unlikely, and yet something told her the police bulletin regarding the Palazzo Vecchio was a cue she should heed.
All cameras out, per favore,
a woman called in accented English. Biantha turned to see a frilly orange pom-pom waving on a stick as a female tour guide attempted to herd her brood of duckling tourists across the Ponte Vecchio.
Above you is Vasari's largest masterpiece,
the guide exclaimed with practiced enthusiasm, lifting her pom-pom into the air and directing everyone's gaze upward. Biantha hadn't noticed it before, but there appeared to be a second-story structure that ran across the top of the shops like a narrow apartment.
The Vasari Corridor,
the guide announced.
It's nearly 1 kilometer long and provided the Medici family with a secure passageway between the Pitti Palace and the Palazzo Vecchio.
Biantha's eyes widened as she took in the tunnel-like structure above her. She'd heard of the corridor, but knew very little about it.
It leads to the Palazzo Vecchio.
For those rare few with VIP connections,
the guide continued,
they can access the corridor even today. It's a spectacular art gallery that stretches all the way from the Palazzo Vecchio to the northeast corner of the Boboli Gardens.
Whatever the guide said next, Biantha did not hear. She was already dashing for her motorcycle.